I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Gas prices are soaring once again, and once again, energy costs are playing out in the political arena. Newt Gingrich said on Saturday, quote, "If you would like to have an American energy policy, never again bow to a Saudi king and pay $2.50 a gallon, Newt Gingrich will be your candidate." President Obama made energy and gas prices the central message of his weekly Saturday address.
You know there are no quick fixes to this problem. And you know we can't just drill our way to lower gas prices. If we're going to take control of our energy future and avoid these gas price spikes down the line, then we need a sustained, all-of-the-above strategy that develops every available source of American energy. Oil, gas, wind, solar, nuclear, biofuels, and more. We need to keep developing the technology that allows us to use less oil in our cars and trucks, in our buildings and plants. That's the strategy we're pursuing, and that's the only real solution to this challenge.
Today in Radio Times, what's driving the rising cost of gas and what, if anything, can be done about it? And we have two guests who have joined us. Robert Kaufman is Director of Graduate Studies for the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University, where he's a professor of geography and environment. Robert Kaufman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Amy Myers Jaffe, the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies, Director of the Energy Forum at the Baker Institute, as well as Associate Director of the Rice Energy Program, joining us from the Baker Institute studios. And Amy Myers Jaffe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning, and let me begin with you, Amy, if I could. Newt Gingrich talks about gasoline at $2.50 a gallon. Is that possible in today's world?
Well, I think he would have trouble implementing that. Our oil prices here in the United States are set with a global market. One might think of the global market as a swimming pool. If you pour water into the shallow end, it's not like it affects the entire swimming pool. And if you take a barrel out, it affects the entire swimming pool. And that is sort of what we have in the global market. Given the situation in the Middle East, it's going to be very hard to bring prices down.
Let me turn to you, Robert Kaufman, and focusing on the Middle East. There has, of course, been unrest there for the last year or so, and a conflict with Iran. How much do you think that has affected the oil prices and the price at the pump?
Well, I think it's certainly responsible in part for the recent about $10 rise in the price of a barrel of crude oil. But it's really hard to see how traders are factoring in these disruptions when they haven't really occurred, and every time there's a story, sometimes there's a big reaction, sometimes there's a lesser reaction.
Are we talking about speculators here?
Well, there's certainly a component of people speculating in the market, but that's always been the case. The big question is whether they've become more important in setting the price as of recent.
Amy Myers Jaffe, do you think speculators are playing a role in the price at the pump?
Well, indeed, back in before 2000, the futures exchange, which is where a lot of the speculation takes place, that was only about 20% financial players, and that's because we had certain rules about who couldn't have large positions in the market. Those rules were changed in 2000, in my opinion, in the wrong way, to allow financial players to take bigger and bigger positions. And in 2007, when we had that giant spike in gasoline prices, and into 2008, the financial players represented 60% of those holding open interest positions, in other words, holding positions in the futures market. So they are definitely a much bigger factor today than they were back in the 1980s and in the 1990s.
And what can be done about that, if anything, Amy?
Well, it's a very simple fix. We can either go back to the old rules about position limits and say that if you're a speculative player, you're a financial institution, you can only take a limited position in the market. The other thing we can do is pass legislation that means that it's very hard to trade on, make a higher margin. In other words, usually traders put down a certain percentage on their position and they only have to pay when they liquidate the position. We could make the amount they have to put as a down payment a larger amount. I personally think position limits worked in the 80s and 90s, and we remember we had the crisis in 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and we didn't see this kind of volatility that we're seeing today. I think if we were to go back to those rules, we could solve a lot of that part of the problem.
Do you agree with that, Robert?
Well, I think that's largely correct. I'm not quite sure about the allusion to the previous war, in that it became pretty clear after that war started that it wasn't really going to disrupt oil supplies, and then prices dropped back. But I think Amy's absolutely correct that there has to be something done to kind of limit the role of speculators in forming prices.
And just picking up on that, Robert, it's the kind of gambling, I guess, that goes on where people are gambling on the increase or the decrease in an oil price?
Well, yeah, but I think I want to be clear. So a certain amount of gambling is necessary. So think about if you're an oil refiner, you contract to buy crude oil at a certain time, and you're not going to get to sell it until 3 months later, 6 months later, so you don't want to really take a position on whether the price of crude oil is going to go up or down in those 3 or 6 months from which you're buying crude oil and going to try and sell motor gasoline. So you have to allow a certain amount of gambling so that refiners can, in a sense, shift that risk off from them to people who are willing to take that risk, who are the gamblers. The question is, how do you keep gamblers from kind of taking control of the whole show?
Well, Amy, let me pick up on Iran. And Iran has certainly threatened to cut off oil exports to France and Britain. But then I was reading that France and Britain import almost no oil from Iran. Iran produces something like 4 million barrels of oil a day. And, of course, we know about some of the conflicts around the Strait of Hormuz. Can you kind of fold Iran into our discussion?
Well, I think the point is when Robert so accurately described, people have to either hedge, in other words, they already have positions in the oil market, and they need to worry about whether the price will change, and then you have speculators who are trying to make money on whether the price will change, and they all have to guess. How much can Iran disrupt the flow of oil? Right. Can they disrupt the Strait of Hormuz for 2 days, 2 weeks? I mean, everybody, I think, kind of agrees they can't close it. But the additional problem is, if there's going to be a war, and, you know, you hear a lot of reports about increasing escalations between the United States and Iran and Israel and Iran, if there's going to be a war and that comes into the price, we call it the war premium, then you have to worry about, well, what's going to be hit with bombs in however many days of hostilities there are going to be. And in the past, the Israelis have said that one of the things they might consider doing is blowing up Iran has one export terminal called Karg Island, and the Israelis have threatened to blow it up, which means that whole 4 million barrels a day is off the market. So Saudi Arabia said they'd replace it, and I know they're making arrangements to do that. They have some storage of oil outside their country. They have a pipeline that goes across Saudi Arabia that can bring somewhere between 5 or, if they use extra drag reduction agents, 7 million barrels a day across to a different place that bypasses the Strait of Hormuz. But the bottom line is, disruption means prices will go up, and people are betting on that.
Robert Kaufman, let me go back to you and actually raise another issue, and this is about demand. And I wonder whether demand in China and India and even demand in the United States has been going up. The economy is showing some signs of improvement. Does that drive up the cost of oil and gas?
Well, it does. And Amy's allusion at the beginning was absolutely correct. There's one big pool of oil. And, you know, anybody who's ever shared a soda with somebody knows if the other person sips harder, it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to end up with less. And so if China is growing rapidly, which it is, their demand is kind of pulling on that market, and the U.S. can't really do much about that. Indeed, if you look at U.S. oil demand, it's actually down relative to where we were prior to kind of the financial crisis in 2008. And so in the U.S. demand's actually down, but China continues to grow, and that's what's important. I do want to add one thing.
Go ahead.
And that's this whole idea of kind of insulating ourselves from these shocks, you know, becoming energy independent. And so I would urge our listeners to think about the following experiment. Suppose that the U.S. produced all of its own oil, and the scenario that Amy just sketched out happened, that we lost Iranian oil and the Saudis were not able to replace it completely, my question would be, do you think U.S. sellers would sell oil, U.S. producers would sell oil to U.S. consumers for 1 cent less than they could get on the world market? And the answer is no. So, and you know, a lot of this discussion about energy independence is not going to insulate us from what goes on in this world oil market because, as Amy said, it's one big pool and it doesn't matter where you're getting your oil from.
Well, just picking up on what Newt Gingrich said, Amy, though, when he talks about having an American energy policy, do we need an American energy policy? Do we have one?
Well, let me just differ from Robert on one point. Part of what makes Americans feel upset when they see gasoline prices go up is they anticipate it's the preluder to a major financial crisis, which it has been many, many times over our history. So one of the things that happens when we buy a lot of imported oil is we are sending dollars abroad to pay for that oil, and our trade balance worsens. In other words, we have start to have a large trade deficit, and that puts pressure on our economy. So if we were paying ourselves for that oil, or we're paying ourselves for that gasoline, that is better than paying a foreign country. Now, when the foreign country we pay is not Canada, but the foreign country we pay is a country, say, in the Middle East, and they have a tiny economy, and they cannot absorb that money. In other words, there's no factories to invest in. There's no general economy to invest in. The money goes to what we call sovereign wealth funds. And what do they do with the money? It flows back out into the international community, chasing for assets. So when you think about the inflation of London real estate or the rising price of stock market values or some of these things, the same thing your pension money is putting money into, that's where the Arab wealth funds are putting their money, and it creates a bubble. And we all know what a bubble does because we all watched the bubble pop in 2008, and we know how bad that is. So, indeed, it does matter how high our imports are because of the destabilizing factor that we, the United States, and not so much China yet, we, the United States, play in importing so much of the oil we use.
And, Robert, about 30 seconds from our first break here, do you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I would just respond very quickly that's true, but the converse is also true. That is, in the early 80s, when the U.S. made a concerted effort to try and reduce its oil dependency, what happened was the oil and gas sector used a very large fraction of U.S. investments to look for that oil, didn't find very much, and so the fraction of GDP coming from the oil industry didn't really rise. And so what happened was we, in effect, flushed a big chunk of U.S. investment in capital down a dry hole or a not very productive well. There's a balance between those two extremes.
And hold on to that thought, only because we do have to take a very short break, talking with Robert Kaufman and Amy Myers-Jaffe about the cost of gasoline. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation, Library, Museum, Center for Scholars, supports WHYY. This first Friday, CHF opens a new exhibition, Inspiring Youth in Chemistry. The exhibit showcases art exploring our chemical world by young people from around the globe. Visitors are invited to meet the curators and take part in chemistry experiments on Friday, March 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. For more information and tour schedules, details are available online at chemheritage.org/firstfridays.
This fall, Arizona and Michigan will be important battlegrounds in the presidential race, and the Republican candidates have already been campaigning hard in those states. I'm Melissa Block. Tomorrow, voters will decide the next two contests in the race for the Republican nomination, and we'll bring you results, reaction, and analysis. Special coverage of the Arizona and Michigan primaries from NPR News.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
For Minneapolis-based MC Dessa, words came first.
My great strength, if I have one, is as a songwriter. The delivery skills were born out of a really strong desire to find a meaningful way to share my writing.
Singer, spoken word artist, and rapper Dessa joins us in the studio this week on Sound Opinions.
Well, I'm sure it's complicated, and And I'm sure your story goes way back.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. And if you drive, you know the gas prices are soaring in some parts of the U.S. We're talking about what's behind the rising prices and what, if anything, the president or anyone else can do about it. And our guests are Robert Kaufman. He's the Director of Graduate Studies for the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University, and Amy Myers Jaffe, Director of the Energy Forum at the Baker Institute. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert, let me go back to you, though. Is the United States more energy independent than it was, let's say, a decade or two ago?
Well, you know, with regards to oil, the answer is yes. There's been an increase in U.S. oil production, ironically, under President Obama. So for all those who complain he's holding back oil production, the numbers don't bear that out. So there's been a rise of about 20% in U.S. Production of crude oil, and there's been, as I said, a slight reduction in U.S. oil demand, how much we're actually using. And when you squeeze on both ends, you actually get a significant reduction in U.S. dependence on imported oil.
And Amy, is in a scenario looking into the future, is it even possible to think of the U.S. as being completely energy independent, or are we so connected to the rest of the world that that's an impossible scenario?
Well, you know, for 30 years it's been impossible, but we have this incredible thing if we manage it correctly, which is we've had a technological breakthrough that is going to allow us to drill for oil and find a lot of oil, not even offshore, onshore in the United States, which was on nobody's radar screen 10 years ago. So if we were to continue in this trend, and I think we will, besides many of your listeners have heard about the boom in oil in North Dakota, well, we're having that same boom in onshore oil here in the Eagle Ford in Texas, and there are plays in the Permian Basin in Texas and in the Niobrara play, which extends into Ohio. So we are going to have more oil production in the United States. At the same time, Nancy Pelosi stuffed through that great bill in 2007 that means that our cars have to get better car mileage, gasoline mileage. So when you put the two things together, you're talking about taking a significant chunk out of our import bill. And if we were to accelerate, if we were to stay the course with the automobile standards and maybe even tighten them or improve them over time, especially if we could get to the point where more people are using electrified cars. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, we were to have more oil production. In other words, we stay the course and don't ban drilling. Then we could be in a very comfortable position in the 2020s. But in the next couple of years, I expect this gap, in other words, that Robert described, where our oil production is rising and our oil demand is falling, that could continue, and it'll squeeze the amount of oil we need from the global market.
And the president, Robert Kaufman, talks about an all-of-the-above approach. Is that a reasonable and smart approach to energy, if not independence? Certainly a better use of energy and fuels?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent approach, because when you think about how oil and energy is used, each energy source has its own particular use. So really, when you talk about oil, the critical uses are for transportation, and whether you think about coal or natural gas, the replacement isn't easy. So if you can do something about oil and transportation, that's important in and of itself, but let's say producing more coal or natural gas isn't necessarily going to solve your transportation energy issue, and vice versa.
But do you think renewables, do you think there's enough either investment and technology that renewables can address this growing need for energy, Robert?
Well, as the president says, it's just part of the solution. So it's unlikely that you'll ever run an electric grid on, let's say, pure wind or pure solar because of the problem of intermittency. You always have to be able to supply electricity as it's demanded in almost near instantaneous time. So if your grid is all solar and a cloud passes over, you've got to be able to make up that electricity somehow. But the technology is progressing so that it is likely we can go beyond that 1 or 2 or 3%. And there are very innovative business models out there right now in which solar companies will come to your house and install solar panels on your house free, and you pay them for the electricity. So there are all kinds of new business models being tried out in the real world that are moving the U.S. in that direction.
Amy, let me ask you about refineries, and there are actually two refineries here in the Delaware Valley that have been at least shut down or going to be shut down, and they produce a fair amount of gas that's used in the East Coast of the United States. Is there enough refining capacity for all this oil we've been talking about?
Well, the interesting thing, you mentioned consumers being upset about gasoline prices. The closure of those two refineries, in addition to bankruptcies for three refineries in Europe, is actually a key factor.
Really?
Why the gasoline price went up now, because it's a little bit, it's a little early for us to be worried about Memorial Day weekend. So those closures had a big impact psychologically on the market. And we have this peculiar thing in the United States. There is one giant pipeline that brings gasoline from down here in Texas up to all of you in the East Coast. And it has limitations. There's limitations of pipeline space, so that the New England market is going to have to be supplied by ship to the extent to make up for those refineries that closed. And the question is, from where? So we have this aberration in the U.S. that's a kind of an anomaly, where it's legally, it's called the Jones Act. If you're bringing a ship from Texas to Boston, it has to be a U.S. flagship with U.S. seamen, but we don't have that many people left that are in that industry. So when the president talked about in his speech in Florida last week, he talked about removing bottlenecks. One of the bottlenecks we need to do, and during Hurricane Rita and Katrina, President Bush had to waive the Jones Act. He had to give people permits to bring gasoline around to the East Coast by ship without using a U.S. flagship. And we're going to have to rethink. We have to rethink the fact that we have over 50 different kinds of specifications for gasoline in different cities based on their clean air status. All of these things create costs for the consumer because we're people in Montana don't want to use the cleaner gasoline that we have to have here in Houston and L.A., and that creates these bottlenecks and inefficiencies that lead to gasoline shortages in a localized way. I think we need to have – the public doesn't understand that, but we need to have more knowledge about that so we can reform the system and make it that gasoline can flow more easily around the country.
Do we need more refineries, Robert Kaufman?
Well, I'm not sure how much capacity was lost here, but in years past, I've looked at this issue, and refineries have to be run 24/7. That's the only way you make money. And if U.S. oil demand is actually declining, as it has, then there's no incentive to build new refineries. People talk about environmental regulations, but what's really driving it is U.S. oil demand, and oil demand has never really kind of grown beyond certain limits that warrant new refineries.
Which leaves people leaving the, sort of a hole.
Which it kind of leaves these regional shortages. So when you shut down refineries in the Philadelphia area or in the Virgin Islands, and now everything has to be moved around again, that causes bottlenecks locally in pipelines, in supplies, and so you can see gasoline prices moving in one direction in one part of the U.S., namely in Boston, and perhaps moving in another direction in the rest of the U.S.
And that's Robert Kaufman. He's Director of Graduate Studies for the Center of Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University, where he's also a professor of geography and environment. Also with us is Amy Myers Jaffe, the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies, Director of the Energy Forum at the Baker Institute, also Associate Director of the Rice Energy Program. We are talking about gas prices, why they are going up, and if and how they can be brought down. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What, if anything, do you think can be done to reduce the cost of gasoline? Let me go back. Excuse me, I got to clear my voice here. One second, hold on. Amy, let me go back to you and actually go back to where the United States gets its oil. And there's all this talk about the Middle East. But again, I was reading, doing my homework for the show, that we actually get most of our oil from Mexico and Canada. Is that correct?
That is correct. And so that's the sort of staring in the mirror issue for me. I believe that Americans make decisions and the Mexicans make decisions that are political, that are not conducive to having good gasoline prices, both for Mexicans and for Americans and for Canadians. So we just had a major political fight about whether or not to extend a pipeline from Canada to the United States. And whereas I can't speak to the routing issue because, in the end, TransCanada could easily have changed the route early on, and that they have a bunch of pipelines that already come to the United States. But there were people in this country who just say, listen, we have to draw the line somewhere and stop using oil and switch to renewable energy, and so we're going to block all pipelines from Canada. Well, this is really irrational. Why? Because you don't have an electric car. So if I have electricity from wind or nuclear power or solar, I can't put it in my car because my car runs on liquid fuel. So you can't put the cart before the horse. And if you're going to use your car, which all those people with the placards, you know, took their car to go demonstrate against the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, if you're going to use your car, you need liquid fuel. On the flip side, Mexico has this sort of crazy politics where they feel that they can't allow any foreigners to come and assist them in their oil industry. And that would be fine as long as they were continuing to send people to get the technical education they needed to be able to drill for oil where they need to drill it, which is in the deep water of the Gulf of Mexico on the Mexico side. But they can't, and so their production has been declining rapidly. And so they are sending less oil to the United States. They are eventually going to be an oil importer. They have gasoline prices that are held low by the government, by certain policies. And so, therefore, their demand is going out of control, growing out of control. So, again, their policies affect the United States. The United States should be a higher diplomacy on Mexico and lower diplomacy on other things. We should not be blocking Canadian production. I understand that Canadian production is higher in greenhouse gases, but the Canadian government, unlike our government, has an actual climate policy. They are closing their coal plants and they are doing other measures to lower their national emissions to make up for the fact that their oil is slightly more emissions intensive.
And we have done whole shows about the AXL pipeline, but let me give Robert Kaufman a chance to weigh in and then we'll get some callers in as well. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just not be so sanguine about Canadian CO2 emissions with the production of these tar sands. It's huge amounts of CO2. It's huge amounts of natural gas being used to produce these tar sands, and then you're running them through pipelines at very high pressures that are more likely to leak. I don't have a strong opinion on the pipeline one way or another, but there are very serious concerns about CO2 emissions and where those CO2 emissions are counted as part of Canada's plan or as part of somebody else's plan.
Let me get, looks like Larry from Warminster to join us on Radio Times. Larry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
I think this is a wonderful discussion.
Thank you.
And I have two questions, one for Robert, and that is, can you have infinite growth in a world of finite resources? And the other question is more for Amy, who's really talking about the demand side. With a $1.233 trillion energy budget in the United States and very good data that 50 to 90% is wasted by the way we use it, couldn't the fastest, surest way, and cheapest way to solve part of the problem temporarily is to eliminate the waste? This would create a lot of green jobs at home.
Fair enough, Larry. And Amy, I guess I'll toss that to you first. How much waste is there in how we use energy?
There's a huge amount of waste in the way we use energy. And let me just say, since I'm on a radio show and so many listeners are listening in their car, one of the big waste items is congestion. When you sit in traffic, that wastes over 1 million barrels a day of oil in this country as people commute at the same time. So that's one thing. Obviously, if we got more people into public transportation, it'd be a huge benefit to the amount of oil that gets wasted. In our homes, we waste a lot of fuel through you know, not the most optimum efficiency standards for buildings. So we've moved a little bit in that direction, and hopefully that'll be something that, as the president talks about his comprehensive energy policy, hopefully whoever's president in the next term will put more emphasis on efficiency. Efficiency is the single greatest bullet we have to make progress in this issue. And just changing the mileage of your car, I mean, forget what the law is. If you, the next time you buy a car that gets 1 gallon more per mile, when that's multiplied across everyone in the United States, it saves about 300,000 barrels a day of oil, just 1 point. So if we start to buy more and more fuel-efficient cars, and if we care about that, we can make a huge difference. But just to give it Americans how powerful a statistic it is, you might recall that a few years ago, President Bush said his target was to reduce gasoline use by 20%. That is just every American driving 40 miles less per week. That's commuting, that's telecommuting 1 day a week from your office, that's carpooling 1 day, that's 1 day on the train. I mean, it is a small contribution that we each could make.
Well, and
just to reduce that much.
And let me jump in here because I want to give Robert Kaufman a chance to weigh in on this as well. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The hard part is the following. If you look at most people's budget, energy is about 5 to 10% of what they spend their dollars on. And so it's really hard in people's busy lives to get them to focus on saving relatively small amounts of money, even though those savings are there. And so, again, I point to these innovative business models where there are ways to get people to pay attention that go beyond kind of the standard economic answer of let's raise prices and that'll make people pay attention. So in this area, out of MIT came a very interesting company called O-Power, and they got people to reduce electricity use, not by tacking, by enlarging people's energy bills, but by literally comparing their bill to their neighbors and putting a little smiley face or a little frowny face on the bill. That got people to pay more attention than the fact that their electricity bill went up by $2 this month or $4 a month, because that's what we're talking about. And going back to the caller's other question for me, which I want to thank Amy for giving me the time to think about this.
Well, and fair, you know what? Only because we're almost up in a break, Robert, I want to give you a chance to think a little bit more, and then we'll take
great.
That break, and then I'll come right back to you. And we are talking about the rising cost of gasoline, and if you've filled up your car or truck in the last couple of months, and you know that you are paying more at the gas pump, we're talking about what's behind these rising prices and what it tells us about the world market for energy, certainly for oil and gasoline. Robert Kaufman, Director of Graduate Studies for the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University. Amy Myers Jaffe, Director of the Energy Forum at the Baker Institute. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Robert Kaufman will answer Larry's first question, and we'll take some more questions at 1-888-477-9499. What should be done about gas prices? Give us a call.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Max Robb and the Potlatch Orchestra returning to the Kimmel Center on Friday, March 2nd. Celebrating the music of the Weimar Republic, the turbulent era between the two world wars, Robb reveals the complexity, intelligence, and ambiguity of that era's music, reminding us that between melancholy and irony, rebellion and resignation, elegy and slapstick, there often lies a single note or a mere word. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or kimmelcenter.org.
Journalist Craig Timberg says for years, international AIDS groups overlooked important factors in the spread of the HIV virus, like the effectiveness of circumcision.
The difference between the men who were circumcised and the men who weren't was 8-1 in terms of their infectiousness.
On the next Fresh Air, Timberg explores the history of the virus and efforts to fight the AIDS epidemic. His new book is Tinderbox. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Poetry can give shape and voice to our darkest feelings of suffering. Research shows writing about difficult moments can be an extraordinarily freeing experience, leading to a sense of safety, renewed energy, and restored order. On the next Voices in the Family, Dan Gottlieb talks with author and teacher Ellen Bass about poetry as a tool for healing. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about the price of gas with Amy Myers Jaffe and Robert Kaufman and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. All right, Robert, you've had several minutes to think. Go ahead.
So I guess I'll retreat to what a person in my department, I'm in a department of geography where space matters. So, and I can connect that to something that Amy just said. Think about all the time you spend in your car wasting time in congestion. Well, part of the reason is space is finite, and so recently the United States celebrated having its population reach 300 million. Well, that's all well and good, but having 300 million people means there are more cars on the road trying to get into those same central business districts. And so what may ultimately be finite are resources, but even space and our ability to really commute in a world in a United States with 300 million people, that may be part of the problem right there.
Well, and that's an argument for telecommuting, right?
Yeah, as somebody who can do that, there is something social about human beings who many people love to come into the office and interact with people on a daily basis.
Amy, do you want to add something? Then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, I telecommuted for 8 years for a company that was based in New York, and I was here in Houston, and I ran a staff of 50 people, and it was very productive. I didn't have to worry about the time zone because, you know, hey, I was in my house. So it is something to consider because not everybody has to go in every day, or not everybody has to go in exactly at 8 o'clock in the morning, which is what causes the congestion. So employers, if we have a crisis in the Middle East, employers are going to have to think about staggered work hours. That can save a lot of fuel just having employees come in at slightly different times in the morning. So there are a lot of creative things we could do if we had the incentive to do it. And unfortunately, I think the Middle East is going to give us that incentive.
Let me get Gene from Fairmount to join our conversation. And Gene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, here in Philadelphia, we're closing a refinery and another one about 10 miles away.
Right.
And isn't that a threat to national security if the federal government allows all the refineries in the United States to close? Couldn't the Energy Department intervene and prevent the closing of these refineries, even if it required adjusting commodities laws to assure that the refineries made a sufficient profit?
Well, and Jimmy touched on this earlier, and not all refineries are going to close, but let me give Robert Kaufman a chance to weigh in on that. Robert?
I'm really not sure about the economics of why that refinery is closing, but it would require a major change in our laws to allow the U.S. government to kind of simply take over a refinery, given how expensive they are to build. My understanding is that those refineries are going to be converted to storage facilities.
Yeah.
Amy,
yes,
do you
that,
know?
That, yeah,
go
that's
ahead, Amy.
Correct. They are going to become storage facilities. Let me talk a little bit about policy.
Sure.
And I'm not sure exactly how we implement that because it would be complicated. But it is bad that these two refineries are closing on the East Coast, and that is because you up there have all experienced what happens when hurricanes close refineries here on the Gulf Coast. So we do not want all of our refineries in the country to be located in one geographical area. This is not a good thing. And although, you know, in answer to a previous question, we do have enough refining capacity nationwide, even without those two refineries, to meet, you know, the kind of demand we've been meeting. Refineries are only operating at about 80% of capacity today, so theoretically they could go up in other locations. The problem is that we do need to think about the logistics of the necessity of fuel in different places. Imagine a terrorist attack in the Northeast where you would need fuel right away to assist people. And think about how hard that's going to be if the gasoline is all down here in Texas and Louisiana. So it is a public issue. And it's a very tricky one because we have a, you know, sort of capitalist society, and we can't force companies to stay in business in different locations if it's not profitable. But we do need to think about why isn't it profitable in a region. And with all due respect to those of you on the East Coast, and you can hear from my accent that I'm from Boston, when people do not want energy-producing facilities in their region because they do not want the downside of those facilities, they put themselves at risk. And it's not a coincidence that, you know, we have a cheaper gasoline prices here in Houston. I mean, there are all kinds of things, but in the end, it's a national issue. And people in New England ought to think about the fact that they themselves use energy, and therefore if they block the construction of energy facilities, whether it's wind off the coast of Massachusetts, or whether it's pipelines down from Canada, or whether it's making it unprofitable to have refineries and oil production in the Northeast, these things all affect people living in the Northeast. You cannot just leave the pollution here in Texas and think that's going to be good enough.
Well, Robert Kaufman, the ball is in your court. Go ahead. You're up there in Boston.
You know, I'm in Boston, so I will say it's not clear to me what the economics are of the refinery in Philadelphia. I don't know why it's closing, but I don't think they've passed any new laws limiting pollution. And I agree with Amy about, you know, Cape Wind Project. Why we don't have that is just beyond me completely there.
Well,
but there are other parts of the country that are just better situated for energy than others. So not to take anything away from Amy's Texas, but if you do have abundant supplies of oil and huge amounts of refineries there, that is one reason why gas prices are cheaper. And also, if you impose lower taxes on your motor gasoline, which has a net effect of encouraging people to drive and not developing mass transit, then, you know, we can get the battle of the regions going on now.
We certainly can, and I'm caught here right in the middle between the two of you. Let me get to, it looks like Jacob from East Falls to join us on Radio Times. And Jacob, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I was listening to NPR a couple of days ago, and I was on the broadcast that talked about the closing of the refineries and how, due to the world market and the cheap natural gas, the United States, for the first time in six decades, has become a net exporter of gasoline. So really, aren't these high prices a reflection of the global market? I mean, in Europe, the gas is much more expensive.
Well, actually, that's a good point, and I'm glad you raised it because we haven't really talked about natural gas, but there is an abundance of natural gas in the U.S. And Amy, do you want to weigh in on that? Just fold that into our discussion about energy?
Yes, I mean, you have an opportunity in Pennsylvania. If you don't like the gasoline price, you know, you could consider having natural gas vehicles and filling stations. That could be an alternative in Pennsylvania. You know, but in terms of the global market, there is no question that the global market sets the price. Part of the problem with the gasoline price in the United States now is not just these Pennsylvania refineries, because like I said, we have a lot of capacity here in the States.
Right.
It's the three refineries shut in Europe. But the important lesson for Europe is that Europe's gasoline demand has not risen for over more than two decades, and that is because they have very high fuel taxes. And in London, there's a congestion tax if you want to bring your car into the center city. So there are things that they do in Europe that Americans would balk at here, but they make sense and they get people to change their habits. And so Robert said, well, you know, we don't want to be forcing people to change their habits through price. But, you know, when we have a crisis in the Middle East, I can tell you, a bigger crisis than we're already having, price will allocate some of these changes because people won't have any choice. They just simply won't be able to afford to use their car. They won't be able to afford to sit in an hour traffic because they feel like it, because they're not going to be able to afford the gasoline.
Robert, you agree? I mean, that the price does price does change people's behavior.
Let me make it clear. I didn't mean to say that prices, we don't want to use prices to influence people's behavior. It's just that people are not attuned to them until they become a big part of their budget. But going back to Europe, yes, motor gasoline taxes and taxes on energy are much higher, but they live in a much more dense society with mass transportation available. And the other thing that we don't talk about, going back to Larry's question, is for many European countries, their population's not growing, and so the number of cars and the number of people driving those cars is not growing, whereas here in the United States, population continues to grow at about a 2 or 3% rate. I'm not saying that's good or bad, but that's one reason that energy demand and oil and motor gasoline demand continues to rise here in the U.S., and doesn't rise in Europe.
And we are talking about gas prices with Robert Kaufman and Amy Myers Jaffe, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's see what Bill from the Northeast has to say. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I believe Amy is correct in the speculators knocking the gas prices up. I don't understand if, as he said, that if we're buying our fuel from the Gulf of Mexico and Canada, why does OPEC get to set the price?
Why does OPEC get to set the price?
Right.
Well, Amy, can I toss that to you?
You know what? I've been thinking about that problem for 30 years, over 30 years. I joke with people that when I was in high school in Swampscott, Massachusetts, I did a term paper which won a contest about why we need to not let OPEC set the price of oil, and it's been my frustration ever since. We allow OPEC to behave and have this organization when we advocate free trade in every other area. We regulate free trade through the GATT and other international mechanisms. And, you know, if I felt that the OPEC countries use the money they make to help their populations, then I would have a different attitude about it. But I am actually, by training, a Middle East expert, and it has not helped the population of Libya or the population of these countries to have this higher oil revenue. It's translated into buying arms, weapon systems. Then we have wars that we see going on now in the Middle East. Iran wouldn't be able to have a giant nuclear program if it wasn't for their oil revenues. North Korea notwithstanding, they would have to, in Iran, they probably wouldn't be able to starve their population to have a nuclear bomb. So the answer is yes. OPEC is, in my opinion, an outdated concept in a global community where we care about human rights and where we care about poverty. Do you realize we're talking about gasoline prices here in the United States? And in OPEC, they're always talking about how we Americans can afford to pay more for oil. But I take engineering students to Africa every summer to try to help people who have no energy. And I can tell you, there is no way to move people out of poverty in sub-Saharan Africa and in East Asia when there is no access to electricity or fuel. Mm. And that is OPEC's fault.
Indeed. Robert, do you agree with Amy?
Well, yes and no. So why is OPEC able to set the price of oil or influence the price of oil? It is because OPEC really controls the marginal supply. So if you actually do a statistical analysis of oil prices, you can explain them. One important explanatory variable is operable capacity utilization by OPEC. If you want an extra barrel of oil right now in the market, you've got to go to OPEC. If OPEC decides to shut in production, there's nobody who can offset that loss of oil. And just to be fair and continue the regional battle here, OPEC is actually modeled after an organization developed in the United States, and that is the Texas Railroad Commission, that acted from the 30s up until 1973, doing the same thing OPEC did with a different political agenda, which was to stabilize oil prices. The Texas Railroad Commission would meet once a month based upon the balance between supply and demand. They would tell their producers in Texas how many days per month they could operate their fields. What happened was the Texas Railroad Commission lost its control over the marginal supply of oil to OPEC in 1973, and now OPEC has a very different agenda, but there are boom and bust cycles in the oil and gas industry that the U.S. didn't want, and now OPEC is kind of taking advantage of.
Well, I know we could have this regional battle continue. I'm looking at the clock here, and I haven't asked either of you, and Amy, let me put this first to you. President Obama talked about ending the $4 billion in tax cuts and subsidies that the oil and gas industries enjoy. He talked about the five biggest companies making something like $137 billion in profits. Is it time to withdraw those tax cuts and subsidies?
Well, certainly the companies he alluded to do not need any tax cuts or subsidies, but I do pick a bone with the president in one area. There's something called the Intangible Drilling Credit. The slogan is IDC, the acronym is IDC. And that IDC is what the little companies use for cash flow. In other words, you have to spend a lot of money before you prepare something for production. And we're talking a lot about natural gas production going up. And it wasn't ExxonMobil or Shell that did that. It was little companies like Mitchell Energy. And they were able to utilize the IDC because otherwise they wouldn't have had enough cash flow to do it. So we owe our better energy fate right now to those little companies and to the IDC, and I'm a little nervous about having the president take it off by telling you, the public, that he's not going to let Exxon have it, because in the end, it was very useful in the United States to solve part of our energy crisis. People are not experiencing high electricity bills in addition to gasoline prices because of the IDC. So we have to be knowledgeable about what taxes...
Sure.
I mean, no question... You know, if there's some tax subsidy going to a large integrated oil company, they do not need that money.
Fair enough. And Robert, I'm giving you the last word, and you have 22 seconds. Go ahead.
You know, the American public's going to pay for their energy one way or another. You're either going to pay for it at its, quote, true market price, or you're going to give your tax money to oil companies, and then you're going to get a subsidized price at some level, and it's a matter of allocation. How do you want, where do you want that money to go, and how, and there's no clear answer there.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Robert Kaufman, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for inviting me again.
You're welcome. And Amy Myers Jaffe, thank you very much as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And she's the director of the Energy Forum at the Baker Institute. Robert Kaufman, director of graduate studies for the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter and send us an email. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.